Back together again, you and I, on Thursday, April the 7th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. On the show, I talked about UConn participating in a plan to pay its student-athletes money for achievement in the classroom. Is that really fair, though, to other high-achieving students who aren't athletes? Connecticut Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, Bright Johnson, joined us again. He talked about a proposal to finally use some national tobacco settlement money in Connecticut on youth anti-smoking efforts. And Yankee Institute of Connecticut President Carol Platt Leibow responded to criticism pointed at her organization from some members of the Connecticut General Assembly. How about this? Let's go here for a minute, shall we? We have talked on this show over the past couple of years about all these proposals to pay student athletes, whether it's a direct payment or letting them cut what are called NIL deals. NIL as in name, image, and likeness. So if they can, for example, like Paige Beckers has with UConn, if you can have a company that pays you by the number of clicks your social media posts get, and you have a company that believes in you, they can sponsor that social media site or other athletes on the UConn team. I think Paige Beckers also is affiliated, I believe, with a clothing and apparel company. I'm not sure. So we talked about that, and I said, well, if you're going to do that, go ahead. I don't think it's a particularly sound thing to do, because to me, it has all the recipe ingredients to create a chasm in the locker room. Two or three players get a lot, a couple get a little, and the rest of the roster gets nothing. So we have debated here athletes getting paid at colleges on the argument that, okay, we know they get a scholarship valued at, you know, 35 to 55, 60, 70 grand a year, but the schools are making, you know, so much more money, we need to give them more. So the whole paying athletes for their athletic performance, okay, I'm still not completely sold on that. But here's another thing now that has popped up, and I saw this today and I went, Well, apparently, according to a bunch of outlets, including 24/7 News, to whom we affiliate, and also ABC News, get this. You ready for this? Sit down for this, boys and girls. Now, understand, and I told you, I was involved with a college athletic program for the better part of 10-plus years, up till a few years ago. Things change, I understand that. And one thing I was highly cognizant of was the time that male and female athletes that I saw was the time they put in the classroom, the time that they put in the classroom, balance that off with the time that they have to play games, practice every day, nutrition, weight room. So, yeah, they are getting a free tuition ride, but it is work in some aspects. But get this, how about paying those student athletes to go to class? How about that? Now, when I was at BU, Boston University, back in the dark ages, you know, when rotary phones, eight tracks, and East Germany were still things, when I was there back in the late 70s and early 80s, I don't recall getting paid to go to class. I don't. I'm guessing that a lot of you out there, maybe not all of you, but I'm guessing that a lot of you out there didn't take cash payments, whether you were an athlete or not, to go to class. Well, I got hit between the eyes on this story today because apparently this is actually happening. And it's either happening now or going to happen at UConn. Go Huskies. We'll tell you more about that coming up. But first, traffic and weather together right here, 246 on WICC. All right, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. So get this. I'm going to read this here. This is courtesy of ABC News and our news partner, 24/7 News. Get this now. And let me know what you think about this. Swish this around in your mouth. See, is that dental thing coming back? Rinse with this, then sit down. The University of Connecticut is one of just 22 top-level NCAA schools agreeing to pay bonuses to student-athletes who also perform well academically. New NCAA rules allow schools to reward student-athletes with nearly $6,000 a year for doing well in the classroom. UConn says it's providing the bonuses just to eligible men's and women's basketball players this year, with plans to add other sports in the future. UConn is in the Big East Conference, of course, and is the only college of the 22 paying bonuses that is not from what they call the Power Five conferences. So, you know, basically, this was set up for the Power Five conferences in football. Now, UConn has a football team. They're not real good. And let's hope Jim Mora Jr. can turn around that train wreck. But having said that, this is interesting. So understand, as I'm reading this here, men's and women's basketball players at UConn and all varsity Division I, Division II athletes, whatever, they're generally on scholarship. There are some walk-ons who pay, but that's rare. You know, you can have non-scholarship spots on certain teams, whatever, basketball, football, baseball. But basically, 99.9% of the men and women that we watch, either in person or on a regional network or on a national network, basically the vast majority of them are on scholarship. So they're already getting an education, room and board worth what if you have to pay, say, at UConn? I know it's different for in-state versus out-of-state, and I know the range can be a little broad there. So, you know, you're talking the value yearly for a varsity athlete at UConn on the basketball team. You know, if they're out-of-state, probably 50, 55 grand, 45, 50 grand, you know, whatever it is. And God bless them. They've worked probably, if they're playing at an elite Division I level, they've been playing hoops or hockey or football or baseball or soccer or running track and field or swimming since, you know, since they could walk. I have a family relative who was a Division I college swimmer, really good, set state records here in Connecticut, set records at the University of Vermont, but after a while she said enough and she needed to have a life her last 2 years in college, and that was fine with her parents. But I know what she went through to be a self-sustaining Division I athlete. So I got no problem with that. Listen, again, like I said, it's not just the classroom burden, but it is the burden of being on a team, of representing a city, a school, or a team, the practices, the team meetings, the physical ed sessions, the workouts, the weight training, the video study. I get that. But we're going to pay, or UConn is joining a group that are going to pay bonuses to student athletes who perform well academically. See, this is where I think when the rubber hits the road here, I could be wrong. And I tell you this all the time, I will never tell anyone of any age, of any demographic group, of any political affiliation, I will never tell anybody not to take money legally given to you. I'm going to say that. So if these athletes at these schools and UConn are offered these bonuses and it's legal, of course you take the money. Of course you do. You don't do this discretion being the better part of valor routine and say, no, not I. I shall not allow this money to sully my soul. No, of course you take it. But here's the question. why are we paying? A, it's a two-part question. You tell me. Why are we paying student athletes to, A, why are we paying them to be in school on top of the scholarship they're already getting, if I'm reading this right? And then, why are we paying them to perform well academically? Is this afforded, this pay, this academic pay, is this fair? Is this afforded to other students at UConn or at any one of these schools? Because apparently, according to this, UConn's doing it. UConn, just one of just 22 top-level schools, agreeing to pay bonuses to student-athletes who also perform well academically. Now, you know why they're doing this, don't you? Because they don't want to lose money-making athletes to academic ineligibility. So here's the thing. They're saying, geez, will you go to class if we pay you and do well? What do you think of all this? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And how would you feel, or how do you feel? Maybe you've got a son or a daughter, or a niece or a nephew, or stepson, stepdaughter, grandson, granddaughter, or you know the kid across the street. You know somebody at UConn, and they're not a varsity athlete. Very, very, very few are, but they bust their tails to do well. They burn the midnight oil. Yeah, they drink beer and they smoke and they get high. I get it. They do other things, but they're good at they're good students. So, where's their cash payment? Where's the green for them? Where are the dead presidents for them? Where's the green Jesus for them, huh? We had this gentleman on a few weeks ago talking about this very subject of tobacco money, and guess what? He's back with maybe some good news here. Bright Johnson is Connecticut Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network. And could the tobacco money finally be going to where it's supposed to go after years and years and years? Bright, hi, it's Paul again at WICC. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. And Bright, I'm no expert in this, but this sounds like good news. Before you say what actually is happening here, lay some of the groundwork here, and I've talked about this for years on my show. Basically, Bright, right, Connecticut gets money from this tobacco settlement, and we really never use it for what it's designed for, right?
That's correct. We've been getting over $100 million annually from the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement for about 20 years now. And unfortunately, less than 1% of the money that's come in from that has actually been used for tobacco control programs in Connecticut.
That is amazing that it's, Bright, it's $100 million a year. So you say less than 1%. So that's less than $1 million. So where does the other 99, I know, rigged question coming up. Where does the other $99 million go?
It goes directly into the general fund.
To plug holes and other spending issues and not to be used for what it was designed for.
That's correct, and that's the big significant flaw of the master settlement is that while the intent of it was that the money be used to help offset healthcare costs relating to tobacco use in each state, the flaw of the language says that states may use the funds for that purpose, not that they shall use the funds. And so any time that there's been any sort of fiscal problems in Connecticut or any other state, one of the first things that lawmakers do is raid the fund.
All right, so what is the news today? Now, nothing is set in stone from what I understand, from what I saw in the news release you sent out, but what, Bright, is the better news on that we have today?
Well, I'm very happy to say that the Appropriations Committee of the legislature released their budget revision for fiscal year 2023, and they included $12 million for tobacco control.
So that's 12% of the $100 million, but still, Bright, and you'd be the expert on this, I would imagine that $12 million can go a lot further than less than $1 million in the types of programs that would benefit from this.
Oh, it absolutely will, yes. The great news is that the budget indicates that the funding is supposed to be spent on programs that follow CDC best practices. And we know from the states that have use this money appropriately, according to CDC best practices, that these practices will help people quit, will help prevent kids from ever starting, and will ultimately end up saving lives and money for the state of Connecticut.
All right. I want to ask you when we come back, Bride, about what we've seen in some of the states. What are some of these states doing that works, and what should we be doing here? The guest, and we'll be back to him momentarily, is Bride Johnson. He's the Connecticut Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network. Big renewed push now, getting money finally to do something with cigarette smoking prevention, early intervention. More with Bright coming up first. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. So good news, after years of getting about $100 million as part of that long-running tobacco settlement, worked out years and years and years ago. After getting $100 million a year, the state of Connecticut is finally at least trying to allocate at least $12 million of that to tobacco prevention programs for kids and maybe some cessation programs as well. Bright Johnson is happy. He directs the government relations arm for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network. So, Bright, before the break, you were saying that states that do this right, do this correctly. What are some of the examples of now what can really be done with this money? Which states are doing some good things?
Quite a few, actually. In California, lung cancer rates declined by a third, and they saw a $55 to $1 return on investment between 1989 and 2008. Maine has reduced its youth smoking rates by two-thirds between 1997 and 2013. Alaska, which is currently one of only two states to fully fund according to the CDC recommendations, they cut their high school smoking rates by 70%. Florida has seen their adult smoking rate plummet from 21.1% to 16.8%, and their youth smoking rate drop to 6.9% from a high of 10.5%. So these are effective programs. They do help. They do save lives. They do save money. And it is something that we should absolutely be doing here in Connecticut.
So now that maybe, hopefully, cross our fingers, Bright, some of this money is going to be spent for that, will we do things like those other states? For example, those successful states, are they doing radio and television advertising? Is this money paid to send experts into schools? What are the nuts and bolts of this? That's what's fascinating to me. How do you get to lower these rates? What's involved in that?
Well, there's a number of programs and services that are available. For example, some people react well to counseling services. Others react to nicotine replacement therapy, the patch, or Chantix, the drug. But not everybody reacts the same way to the same things and over the same time period. What's critically important is that if this funding is restored and we do engage in these programs and services, continuity of services is absolutely critical because, again, not everybody's going to be able to quit based off of one method or based off of a certain amount of time. So this funding needs to be ongoing year after year after year so that people that sometimes take longer to quit will still have access to these services and they won't be taken away in the middle of a quit attempt.
And so this money, Bright, hopefully this $12 million or so, this will directly pay, for example, for nicotine packages, patches, Chantix, counselors. That's where the outlay of this money will help?
Potentially, yes. What the provision in the budget will do, it reestablishes what's called the Tobacco and Health Trust Fund. And that trust fund has a board that will be appointed, and the board will hold hearings and make recommendations to the legislature on how that money is spent. So there are any number of opportunities to be able to weigh in, and there are any number of methods that could be utilized in the future.
Now, finally, I know, Bright, this money is in there now. Have you received or heard of any assurances that it will not be stripped out or reallocated again? This won't become part of a shell game as the process moves through?
Well, that's the hope, that that it won't be reallocated. There are no guarantees, of course. The budget still needs to go through negotiations with the between the legislature and the governor's office, and we're hopeful that people will chime in with their lawmakers and call the governor and urge a passage of the budget with this provision in it.
Bright, thank you. Bright Johnson, Connecticut Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Bright, thanks. We appreciate it. We'll be in touch. Be good.
Thanks, Paul.
All right. Appreciate it. Bright Johnson there again. He is Connecticut Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. It's about a renewed push to finally, how about that? Isn't that amazing? Now we're finally going to use some of this tobacco settlement money to at least maybe keep kids and young people from smoking. And again, isn't it amazing there that there was one word, like Bright said, one word in this whole settlement that diverted hundreds of millions of dollars a year away from what the money was supposed to be used for? Instead of must be used for anti-smoking programs, shall be, I think he said the wording is can or should be used. Think about that. As we draw up our laws and how our laws are used and formulated, how one or two words can shift money like that. Welcoming it back, Carol Platt-Leibau, who heads the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in the state. Checking them out, the website is yankeeinstitute.org. You can also follow them on social media. Hey, Carol, it's Paul. How are you again?
I'm great. Glad to be with you and your listeners, Paul.
Carol, you, oh my God, you folks seem to have hit a nerve. Now, before we get to your Wall Street Journal op-ed, which was quite good, I think, Carol, you have perhaps hit a nerve with some of the state employee unions and the some state legislators who have come out guns blazing against you, Carol. What are you doing to anger them so much? I don't get it.
Gosh, I don't know. I think, you know, Harry Truman once said, they say I'm giving them hell, but I just tell the truth and they think it's hell. And so I think it's something like that. They're unhappy because really what they are is nothing more than just pro-status quo special interests. And we really, at Yankee Institute, this kind of complaining, we just take it as a compliment, Paul, because we expose their destructive policy agenda. And all these so-called reports, you notice that there isn't a single solution in it. There isn't a single policy proposal in any of them. It's nothing but attacks on us and on our proposals, which really are efforts to empower people rather than the government. And so, you know, I think that's a compliment. It's a tribute to our work, and it's telling us that we're effective in trying to fight for people rather than government.
I'll give you a chance before the break here, Carol, to respond to an allegation here. There are allegations being made by Representative Robin Porter, Democrat New Haven, and Democrat State Rep Ann Hughes of Easton, that you folks at Yankee Institute take funding, quote here, from the same groups who also donate to right-wing hate groups named by the Southern Poverty Law Center, unquote, according to the Connecticut News Junkie. Carol, your reaction to that would be?
Well, first of all, a lot of this is just an effort to smear people and this kind of guilt by association. And at Yankee Institute, as you know, Paul, we don't disclose our donors because we believe that transparency is for government and privacy is for people. So they don't know who our donors are. And I would also point out that if I were they, I would be a little bit embarrassed to be taking advice from anyone like the Southern Poverty Law Center. I would advise that they read some of the accounts of the goings-on at the Southern Poverty Law Center as laid out in The New Yorker, because it seems to me that given what has been alleged about the Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, it has enough problems of its own without trying to point fingers at anybody. And at Yankee Institute, we are proud to accept support from a wide variety of individuals and organizations, and that means they agree with our agenda and our priorities, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we agree with theirs.
You know, Carol, it is it sometimes in such a great state as we have, I get very upset, and you obviously get this too with your organization, and generally myself and a few other talk radio hosts around the state. I mean, the attitude that people approach us, Carol, who have maybe similar ideas is, well, damn it, how dare you have a different opinion? There must be something wrong with you. That really upsets me. It really does.
Well, it's just ridiculous. And so what I would say to these people is, you know, instead of trying to just stoop to this kind of smear campaign, especially when many of their smears are just distorted or inaccurate, we would hope that they would engage with us on the issues and on ideas and offer their proposals for improving the lives of the people throughout our state, because that's why we're here, and that's what we hope they will join us in doing. You know, there's so much ugliness and destructiveness throughout the world. Let's do better. Let's work together to make things better for the people in our state. And when you have people who only want to tear down others rather than trying to work constructively to make life better, that's when you know that all you've got is a special interest that wants to simply maintain its own position rather than working for the good of everyone.
Carol, hang on. We'll be right back with you, and we're going to get into, I want to, in the second half of our chat today, a little bit on your op-ed that was in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago. Carol Platt-Leibau runs, she is head of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut. I know. How dare there be an institute with conservative values in the state? Doesn't fit in here. It just doesn't fit in. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Hey, a couple more minutes here with one of our regular guests, contributors. Carol Platt-Leibau heads the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Check them out online, yankeeinstitute.org. Also, you can check out their social media feeds. They are not the shadowy group that a number of people make them out to be if they're on the union negotiating side. Carol, you had a piece published a couple of days ago in the Wall Street Journal. Not an easy thing. Some people don't read the journal. They can't get beyond the paywall. They don't get it electronically. So for folks that didn't see the piece, which has got quite a bit of a number of interesting comments here, what did you summarize there? And how did you position the state of Connecticut, I see, against Wisconsin that was in the news a few years ago?
Well, sure, Paul. What we were talking about in the piece is the contrast between Connecticut and Wisconsin, and how Governor Lamont said in 2019 that he wanted an anti-Wisconsin moment, which was a little dig at Governor Scott Walker and the fiscal reforms that Governor Walker instituted in 2011. And Governor Lamont said he wanted to show that collective bargaining works. And this year, he definitely showed that collective bargaining works. It's just that it doesn't work for anyone who doesn't, in fact, have a job with state government. For them, it works incredibly well. If Hartford and the legislators there sign on to this new agreement and these new contracts, here's what's going to happen, and here's what the taxpayers of Connecticut will be paying for. State employees are going to get $2,500 bonuses, back pay averaging nearly $2,000, and raises between 2.5% and 4.5%. And then, as they say on all those late night TV commercials, but wait, there's more. They're going to get another $1,000 bonus and more raises in July. And this is exactly around the time the unions will decide whether to offer Governor Lamont's reelection bid the same kind of intense support that he received in 2018. And, you know, the thing that really is a little bit difficult to stomach about all this, Paul, is when you look at the contrast between this government sector and the private sector. Because in the spring of 2020, when the pandemic was at full roar, one in six private jobs disappeared. And at that point, government employees were contractually protected from any kind of layoffs. And then the summer of 2020, when private sector employment was still above 10% and our state finances were just decimated, state employees got 3.5% raises and also received seniority-based raises that averaged 2% beginning in the start of 2021.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you end up with a sort of two-tiered system here in our state, the people who work for the government and then the private sector, which also in a more indirect and different way also seems to be working for the government support it.
Yeah, and the thing I think that's frustrating to me and to you, Carol, and to a lot of people, and I always say this, look, nobody is saying that state employees don't deserve to get paid, to get a fair pay for what they do, to get a fair benefit package. But these contracts are essentially negotiated in secret, and they're essentially rubber stamped in secret. And there is, Carol, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's really no chance, is there, to really substantively challenge anything that's in these deals. It's like, you will take this and you will like it.
Well, Paul, you know, in the past, sometimes at least 20 years ago or so, or a little more than that, the legislature has at times seen reality and walked some of this more extravagant stuff back. So it is worth reaching out to those who represent us or who claim to and telling them, you know, this is not right. And we certainly want our state workers to be compensated fairly. But at a certain point, it's worth asking, is government supposed to be working for us, or are we supposed to be working for government? And, you know, when you think about it, Governor Walker in Wisconsin reversed decades of union privilege. And when he did this in 2011, he, you know, over time, what it did is it erased a multi-billion dollar deficit, and that is what allowed Wisconsin to deliver substantial tax relief. And, you know, we're going in precisely the opposite direction. We've had multiple substantial tax increases, and it would be one thing if we had something to show for it. But instead, we see that the United States is on track to regain all the jobs lost by COVID this year.
Mm-hmm.
Connecticut isn't on track to do it until next year. And so it would be one thing if our state were zooming ahead as a result of this sort of policy and outperforming the rest of the United States. It's not. In most ways, it underperforms. We need a different direction.
Absolutely. Carol Platt-Leibau heads the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Check him out online, all the social media feeds, as well as yankeeinstitute.org. Carol, be good, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Well, thanks. No promises, Paul, but I always appreciate being with you and your listeners.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Thanks, Carol.
All right. Thanks so much.
Be good. Traffic and weather together, and we'll come back, chat a little bit about this. So a couple thoughts to add there. Once again, folks, check out the op-ed by Carol Platt-Leibau regarding, you know, the spending here that continues. It's in the Wall Street Journal. It was posted on April 5th, which was, let's see, 2 days ago on Tuesday. So check that out. Check them out online at yankeeinstitute.org.